What are some of the myths of gospel reductionism? I've written part two of an article titled Better Than Good, Failed Attempts to Improve on the Gospel in the latest issues, etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Joy Pullman of The Federalist writes about her journey from charismatic experientialism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal. That's Jesus, thy blood and righteousness, talking about being arrayed in the righteousness of Jesus Christ. Now, that, of course, is a tremendous truth of Scripture for us, that we are clothed in the righteousness of Jesus Christ, that His blood covers us and washes us free of all sin. Those robes that have been washed in the blood of the Lamb and made white in His blood. Does that have any application? Does it have a way of actually showing up in the worship life of the church? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be doing part seven of our series, Setting the Lord's Table. Today, we're going to talk not so much about the table or what's on the table, but how one dresses when serving at the table of the Lord, vestments for clergy and for lay assistants. You might have seen a lot of variety in this respect. Everything from designer t-shirts and blue jeans to, well, the kind of vestments that some people might say make you look Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox, and everything in between. We're going to be talking about that, trying to sort some of it out so that not only the names are a little more familiar, but why it is the clergy dress the way that they do, why those who serve at the Lord's table dress the way they do. A little bit later, we'll be reviewing the movie Silence. Pastor Ted Giese will be our guest. Then Terry Mattingly will join us, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. We'll talk about NBC News and its story about the Democrats' race and culture. You can join us with questions or comments over the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, and the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Pastor Will Wheaton joins us for our series, Setting the Lord's Table. We're going to talk about vestments for clergy and lay assistants at the Lord's Table. He is Director of Worship and Chaplain of the International Center for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, host of a radio talk show called Thy Strong Word, and author of the book Celebrating the Saints. Will, welcome back.
Hey, thank you, Ty. What a joy to be with you today.
Most would probably just assign this to preference. They would say, that pastor wears the full regalia. I don't know what it's all called, but I know there's a lot of layers there, and it looks very fancy and beautiful, very ornate. That's how he likes to look on Sunday morning. This pastor over here is maybe somewhere in between, and then this guy over on the other end of the spectrum, it's just street clothes. Maybe if we're lucky, he tucks in his shirt, something like that. But it's all a matter of preference. Therefore, it really makes no difference whatsoever. How would you respond?
Well, you know, when we talk about the matter of preference, I remember hearing, I had a conversation on the radio many years ago with the person who shall remain nameless, who asked, so really it comes down to this, in all worship style, everything about worship, it really is just what the pastor prefers, right? And I remember looking at him and thinking, why would you come up with that idea? I said, I serve a parish where I don't actually do what I prefer almost any Sunday. And he looked at me, he's like, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, if I had my druthers, we'd be swinging incense every single week. Well, I don't think that would necessarily be helpful to my people, so it's not something that I'm going to insist on or force on them. So the whole point of vestments is precisely not to deal with pastoral preference. It's, in fact, to clothe over and cover over the individuality of the man and his preferences and his taste and his, well, frankly, you know, how fine the duds are that he puts on, and to clothe them instead in something that is decidedly neutral. And what I mean by neutral is It doesn't, it's not to say anything at all about the man, and is designed to say everything instead about the office. How many times have you heard somebody say, well, you know, the clothes make the man? And I don't know, by that they can mean that, somebody's a real fancy dresser, it looks real nice. But I often think, too, that the term the clothes make the man show, if you see a guy dressed in a cop's outfit, you might assume, that guy might be a cop. Probably is, right? Unless he's playing a cop.
You might be safe to assume.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, at least the place that you would start out with, right? Somebody dressed up like a nurse, you would think, that person might be a nurse. Somebody dressed up like, I don't know, an auto mechanic, right? You know, they got their jumper suit on and they got their name there. You think, oh, that person might work on cars. The point is, we have all these social expectation with clothes. We're not saying that all these things are, or any of these things, are biblically mandated so, but they do communicate. They give pieces of information just by the article of clothing being worn, right?
What you're talking about there really is the idea of a uniform.
A uniform! Exactly.
And a uniform does two things. It, as the adjective might denote, everyone ends up looking the same. The individual preferences are muted or covered up.
Right.
That's the first thing you mentioned. The other thing, a uniform, and they identify the task at hand. That's another thing. And then the third thing that a uniform really does is it kind of says, when I'm wearing this, what I'm doing isn't mine. In fact, even really the clothes aren't mine. In the military, there's latitude, but in the military, when someone is in uniform, they're not allowed to do little flourishes of their own style. They don't say, hey, I like to wear my uniform this way. It's worn according to a code, precisely because the clothes really say, like the pastor's vestments, these aren't my clothes.
Yep.
These are the church's clothes.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, the just like the military guy is under orders, the pastor's uniform is there to remind him that he is under orders, and the people too. And how many times have you had this happen to you? I know you have, where you're wearing your uniform. And this time, just talking about wearing a clerical, if you will, just a collar, whatever that identifies. If people look at that and go, oh, he's either Roman Catholic, Anglican, Lutheran, or, Orthodox, maybe Presbyterian, Methodist. But I mean, they see the uniform and they know that's a minister, right? And so you're in the hall at the hospital. And what happens? A person comes up to you and says, could you give me a blessing? Could you pray with me? It identifies. And that's really all I want to stress at the beginning about why these things might be of use in the church is because they really do serve a purpose culturally to identify the people who are wearing them as being in the office. And they have this ability to sort of cover up the individual preferences and individual likes, to be, in fact, the antithesis of doing it your way. You're doing it instead the church's way, the way it's sort of been handed down to you. Now, I want to be really, really, really clear. They are most absolutely adiaphorin. If a pastor wears an ob, or if he wears full Eucharistic vestments, he dresses to the nth degree, it doesn't add one thing more to the Eucharist than if he were standing up there in his business suit doing the same thing. We want to be really clear on that. These are things that humans have come up with. They have no divine inspiration by themselves.
Or mandate or institution.
Yeah, I shouldn't say inspiration, because they actually do have a divine inspiration. And that's where I want to sort of go next. It's like, where does the idea even come from that there are special clothes to be worn when serving up to God's people, God's gifts? Where does that idea come from? Well, if you open the pages of Scripture, it doesn't take you very long before you start encountering how huge this idea of clothing is. I mean, let's start at the very beginning, right? No clothes. Adam and Eve walking around naked, it says, and not ashamed. But as soon as the fall into sin happens, they immediately recognize something is wrong. And what's the very first thing that they do? The very first thing.
They cover themselves up.
They try to make themselves clothes.
They make aprons.
They make fashions for themselves. They're fig leaf fashions to try to cover their nakedness. And, you know, it just doesn't work that well. So when God comes calling, they go running because they still know that despite their clothes, they're still naked. But God, in great mercy and love, He provides clothes for them. We're told skins, as implying that an animal has died so that they might be clothed and live. An innocent victim in their place, and then they are covered with that clothing. That already sets a picture for what clothing is going to be throughout the whole of Scripture. But then, when God takes a people apart for Himself and teaches them how they are to worship Him, one of the first things He lays down, Exodus chapter 28, is that there's going to be special clothing that those who are serving Him and so serving the people are going to be wearing that will immediately identify them as being, if you can put it this way from the Old Testament, in the Old Testament office of the ministry. You could see it by what they wore when they served.
So we're talking here about those white linen ephods of the Levites. We're talking about the priestly garments all the way up to the very heavily freighted with symbolism garments of the high priest.
Yeah, and let's just deal with some of how it's described in Exodus. I mean, if our hearers want to turn to Exodus 28, they can get sort of a feel for what this looked like. And before we look at it, I want to remind all our hearers, everything that the Old Testament gives to the priests comes in the New Testament to the priestly people of God. So you're going to see a pattern that we'll run through here. And this is so huge. Well, I don't want to get ahead of myself. So let's just start at Exodus 28 and we'll go from there. In Exodus 28, God tells Moses, "Then bring near to you Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the people of Israel to serve me as priests. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. And you shall make holy garments for Aaron and his brother." And then what's this next phrase? "For glory and for beauty." That little phrase is repeated every time the garments are mentioned, these special priestly garments, for glory and for beauty. The vestments reflect something of the glory of God, and they are beautiful to behold. I confess, I don't quite get the Hebrew checked pattern of the high priest's outfit, you know, being beautiful, but, you know, the intention was these things are, that people look at them and they see something of the glory of God, and they recognize them as actually being themselves beautiful works of art. Goes on, "You shall speak to all the skillful whom I have filled with the spirit of skill, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him for my priesthood. These are the garments they shall make: a breastpiece, an ephod, a robe, a coat of checkerwork, a turban, and a sash. They shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons to serve me as priests. They shall receive gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet yarns, and fine twined linen, and they shall make the ephod of gold, of blue and purple and scarlet yarns, and a fine twined linen skillfully woven." And then, I mean, just in intricate detail about how the entire set of the vestments are to be made. So when you looked at the Old Testament priests doing their job, the beauty of their garments testified to the beauty of the love of God that was being ministered by them to the people, and it also testified to the glory of God. You saw something of the glory of God, the shimmer of the gold, if you will, shining from the vestments, to say, what's going on here is not ordinary. What's going on here is sacred, is most holy, is very special. So their ministering was marked by the clothes they wore.
Pastor Will Whedon is our guest. It's part 7 of our series, Setting the Lord's Table. Today, we're talking about vestments for clergy and lay assistants in the divine service. He's director of worship and chaplain of the International Center for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. When we come back, more of that biblical material on the clothing of God's servants, and then we'll talk about how pastors and the lay assistants in the divine service are clothed. What are some of the myths of gospel reductionism? I've written part 2 of an article titled Better Than Good, Failed Attempts to Improve on the Gospel in the latest issues, etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Joy Pullman of The Federalist writes about her journey from charismatic experientialism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Christological. Creedal. Confessional. You're listening to Issues Etc.
At Concordia Evangelical Lutheran Church of Wilmington, Delaware, our mission is to serve our community by sharing Christian hope. We've been doing this since 1938 and joyfully continue to do so in the 21st century. If you're ever in the city that DuPont Chemical Corporation calls home, or is known by some as the credit card capital of the world, we hope you visit to receive Jesus through His Word and Sacrament. Otherwise, check us out on the web at ConcordiaWilmington.com.
Oh, morning star, how morning star, shine from bright
throne. Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Part 7 of our series, Setting the Lord's Table, we're talking about the vestments for clergy and lay assistants. Pastor Will Whedon is our guest. So you got us all the way up to Aaron and his sons clothed in this finery that God really designed in great detail for them to wear.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so many other places we could, you know, look at the clothing thing, but at least we should look at what happens in Zechariah 3. This is a fascinating moment too. Zechariah 3, then the angel, he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. And the Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, O Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this a brand plucked from the fire?" Now Joshua is standing before the angel clothed with filthy garments. And the angel said to those who were standing before him, "Remove the filthy garments from him." And to him he said, "Behold, I have taken your iniquity away from you, and I will clothe you with pure vestments." And I said, "Let them put a clean turban on his head." So they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him with garments. And the angel of the Lord was standing by. And the angel of the Lord solemnly assured Joshua, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, if you walk in my ways and keep my charge, you shall rule my house and have charge of my courts, and I will give you the right of access among those who are standing here." So, I mean, go on with the chapter, but the point being, Joshua himself, in his filthy garments, had to be clothed again by Yahweh, clothed at Yahweh's command. And what does the clothing symbolize here? It's very clear. I have removed your iniquity from you, and I clothe you with pure garments. the sins gone, and then clothed in righteousness. And he has, by virtue of his being, his sins being gone and him being clothed with this beautiful gift of righteousness, he then has right of access. You think about the high priest, he's the only one who had right of access into the Holy of Holies. He only had it once a year. But this is exactly pointing to what Jesus came to do, to give right of access to those people whom he had taken their sins away from and whom he had clothed in his own righteousness. I mean, if we'd read further, I mean, it goes on, you know, I remove the iniquity of this land a single day. It definitely is referring to the great act that Jesus himself would do by his own atonement. And remember, on the cross, he is stripped of his garment, that his, this seamless rope, if you will, might be given to his people, that they might be clothed in his holiness. Now, back to what I was trying to say earlier, and then I interrupted myself because I didn't want to get too far ahead. Everything in the Old Testament for the priesthood bumps up in the New Testament to the people of God, not to the clergy. Let me be clear on that again. Everything of the priesthood in the Old Testament belongs in the New Testament to the whole priestly people of God, which is why, you know, like you meet in Revelation, in the greeting, you know, I made them a kingdom and priests to my God and Father. Or the way Peter would say in chapter 2 of his first letter, a kingdom of priests, a royal kingdom. This is a royal priesthood. This is what the entire baptized people of God are. So when you think about the white robes then that appear throughout Revelation, right? Anytime you see the church in Revelation and the people are described, how are they described? Wearing white robes, palm branches in their hands, right? You know, Revelation 7. So this picture of the white robe covering them is actually the baptismal garment. And this is huge for why the church actually still has the clergy wear this. They're not wearing that to say, see, I'm set apart from you and I am holy and you are not. No, nonsense. The whole people of God have been made holy by the blood of Jesus, baptized into him. In fact, when a little child is baptized, you're usually clothed in white, right? I mean, the garment of white to cover them. The same white that appears over the casket when they go into the grave, right? Clothed in the baptism. By baptism, they are clothed in Christ's own righteousness. The pastors wear that to confess, above all, the righteousness that belongs to the whole people of God, which is why those foundational garments that we're going to talk about, the alb or the cassock and surplice, they actually don't belong to the clergy alone. They belong to anybody who's actually up front assisting, because they're just confessing that which is the property of the entire people of God, the white robe of Christ's righteousness.
So that's the baptismal garment. And that's appropriate for any, you said alb.
Let's go ahead and talk about each of the individual parts of these vestments. And I've got the Maxwell's work here in front of me. I do want to stress, he says that that you need to consider the vestments under a twofold aspect, liturgical and universal. The liturgical purpose of the vestments is that they mark the person who's performing a specific liturgical function. You can tell what they are, what they're doing by what they're wearing. The universal purpose of vestments is they provide continuity with the church across the ages. We're not doing anything new. This is just kind of how the church has been doing this for a very, very, very long time. He notes the vestments as they came into usage. They were really just mostly, for the most part, the garb of antiquity. I think we've talked about that before. I mean, they were just the way that people in the Roman Empire dressed. I mean, that sort of carried through. And the church is slow to change. When everything else changed around it, that thing didn't change. But then it came to be endued with a symbolism, if you will, a confession of what's going on that was borrowed. And each of the vestments says something about what the person is that's wearing it. So, I mean, you mentioned alb. Alb is sort of the baseline vestment. The alb is just It just literally, albat literally means white, like albino. You can hear it in there, white. And it was just that white robe. It's the sort of robe that you read about in Revelation. It is the base garment, if you will. In the Middle Ages, if you're in Northern Europe and you had a church and it was cold in the winter and you didn't have central heating, underneath your garment, you would be wearing a nice fur-lined, what's called a cassock, which is the black garment. But then your alb is going to be a little snug, squeezing down over your fur-lined black garment. So what they invented, the surplice, which literally means, you know, the over the fur lined. So it's an all a surplice is. It's the more flowy white garment that that can be used over top of a cassock. It just is more comfortable, and it was much more common in Northern Europe. In our practice, both of those continue and sort of interchangeably. You can see them in many times in the same service. You're a cassock and surplice man, if I remember correctly.
Well, I had been for years, and then when I came to a congregation that their practice was cassock and surplice very occasionally, and mostly alb. We went back to alb, and then things that cover that.
Okay. So, I mean, the alb itself then is just this long, think of it as a tighter fitting surplice, fuller, full white garment. And, originally the thing was made of linen. Now today it's made of whatever cheap fabrics we can get it to be made of.
Easy to clean, whatever.
And usually people are concerned about what hangs neatly and doesn't wrinkle. That's good, you know, so that people don't sit up there and say, boy, pastor's looking a little rumpled this morning, isn't he? Again, because the vestments are not designed to draw attention to the man, but actually to help cover him up, to help him to sort of disappear. And that is the alb, the usual vestment for the celebration of the Holy Eucharist, the base vestment, if you will. And usually with it goes a stole. And that is just the Greek word out of the New Testament, actually, for any kind of a long flowing garment. But the way we've come to use it is it's a scarf, if you will, that goes around the man's neck. It either hangs straight or it crosses, depending on whether a man is a pastor or whether he is a deacon. And this confesses, though, if you're wearing the stole, it's not just a member of the laity up front. It is a member, all clergy are laity. You know what I mean by that, right? But it is a member of the laity, which has been set into the office of the ministry in some fashion, either as deacon or as pastor. And then it also, the stole serves another purpose. It's always in the color of the season. So just like we said on the altar, there the you see green, you know, oh, it's kind of like the season of post Epiphany or Trinity. It's the church's ordinary time or post Pentecost season. You see white, oh, big festival today. See red, somebody died. It's a martyr's festival or Pentecost, the fire the color of fire of Pentecost. You see blue, time to think about Advent. You know, or purple, the time of Lent. The stole will match whatever's on the altar and the pulpit. And in our usage, that the pastor, that's sort of like, I think, in our Lutheran church, that's kind of like base, that usage that you have an alb and a stole up in front of the congregation most Sundays. I think that's pretty normal now.
It wouldn't have been that way, say, 50 years ago.
Yeah, 50 years ago, it was probably more normal to have the surplice and cassock and the stole, which, by the way, the combo of those three is something that Lutherans just lifted 100% from the use of the Episcopal Church here in the 19th century. That's actually not historical Lutheran practice. The use of the cassock and the surplice was reserved in general for if you were an assisting minister at the Eucharist, but not the presiding minister, or if it was an office that was not the Eucharist. So if you're presiding at a prayer service or at a baptism or for the litany, or if you're presiding at a funeral, you'll have the cassock and the surplice. But the alb in general was held to be of use for the celebration of the Eucharist, and most often for those people who were assisting at the Eucharist.
So at this point, I'm picturing this in my mind. We either have a man standing in a white robe
that's tight, or a white robe that's flowy,
fits to the body, a white robe, and that is either covered at this point in your description by simply a stole, a long flowing scarf-like piece mm-hmm. of cloth in the color of the season, or we might see a man standing in a black cassock covered by a kind of loose-fitting white overgarment that would be like the alb, and then also wearing a stole.
Right.
Those are the kind of the two different pictures we're seeing here.
And that, I mean, if we reach back to 50, I mean, to when we were kids, that's the way they usually look like one way or the other. But there was this, you know, been a decided movement in our church more toward the alb and more away from the cassock and surplice in general. Let's also deal with something Maxwell deals with. He says, this matter of body offering. So there was a time, you went back 100 years, where instead of any of that, the Lutheran clergyman would be standing in front of his congregation wearing a black, what's called Geneva gown. He showed he was Lutheran, if you will, not by the garment itself, because everybody wore them, the Presbyterians, the Reformed, everybody wore them, but by the so-called befken, the collar that he wore around his neck in honor of a nice proper distinction between law and gospel. A Lutheran befken had two tabs in the front. The Reformed had a single tab. The Union churches had an interesting single tab with a split in it. So, I mean, you literally could see again what confession a man had by the uniform he was wearing.
As we go into this break, anyone who remembers had the honor of seeing Dr. Norman Nagel preach, usually in the chapel of Concordia Seminary there. If I remember correctly, it was the black robe with usually the two tabs hanging down. You always knew he's going to preach that day if he came to class.
If he wore his tabs.
With
yeah,
his two Befken. Tabs hanging yeah. down. Pastor Will Wheaton is our guest, part 7 of our series, Setting the Lord's Table. We're talking about the vestments for the clergy and the lay assistants. In hour 2 of Issues, Etc., we'll review the movie Silence, and we'll talk with Terry Mattingly about an NBC piece featuring the Democrats' race and culture.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Come listen to Drs. Alvin Schmidt and Roland Elke at the 3rd Annual Concordia Apologetics Conference, Cultures in Collision, Faith and a Fractured World, this March 3rd and 4th at Concordia University, Wisconsin. You can register online at www.cuw.edu/apologetics or call 262-243-4343. That's the Concordia Apologetics Conference, March 3rd and 4th at Concordia University, Wisconsin.
Male and female sex differences, contraception, transgenderism. These are some of the topics covered in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Ethics of Sex, From Taboo to Delight. You can find out more at issuesztc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Ethics of Sex contributors include Issues Etc. guests Ben Mays, Tom Eckstein, and Richard Stuckwish. Ethics of Sex, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Evangelical and Catholic. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation with the new Martin Luther plush figure. It features the 16th century reformer holding the Bible and Luther's morning and evening prayers. Go to reformationgear.com, use the coupon code ISSUESETC, and 20% of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. reformationgear.com, the new Martin Luther plush figure, reformationgear.com, and enter the coupon code ISSUESETC. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the vestments that are worn by clergy and lay assistants in the divine service. Part 7 of our series, Setting the Lord's Table, with Pastor Will Whedon, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Will, tell us about the 2017 Institute on the Liturgy, Preaching, and Church Music that's going to be held late in July, July 25th through the 28th at Concordia University, Chicago.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. That is such a great, it's going to be such a great conference. The conference is centered on the just live by faith. Make this plain in sermon, service, song. And we're going to have keynote on sermon by Pastor David Peterson, who I think you and I would agree is one of the absolute greatest preachers the Missouri Synod has.
I think so.
And then the in service, we're going to have, you know, make this plain in service. Pastor Bill Swirla will be on helping us understand how we graciously preside at the service. And then on in song, cantor Kevin Hildebrandt will be unpacking that for us in the keynotes. New this time around, we're having Bible studies each of the three full days of the Institute, led by, we're at Concordia, Chicago. Where else? Who else will we have to lead it? Chaplain Gard, Dr. Gard, the president of Concordia University, Chicago. And of course, you know, I guess now we have to say retired admiral. Do you keep the title? I don't know if you keep it forever, don't you?
It's, once an admiral, he would be admiral retired.
Admiral retired. Yeah. You know, it's just a delightful man. Of course, a scholar of the Old Testament. So we're really looking forward to that. We're going to be looking at three chapters of, guess what? Habakkuk. Why? This is the Reformation anniversary. Where did Luther get the idea that the just live by faith from? Where does the idea come that you need to make it plain that the just live by faith? Chapter 2 of Habakkuk. And of course, Habakkuk ends in a glorious canticle, beautiful song, that the fig tree does not blossom and there be no fruit in the vine, the produce of the olive fail and the fig tree yield no fruit. Though the flock be cut off from the fold and there be no herd in the stall, yet will I rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. This is going to be a fabulous conference. And on Tuesday evening, we have the National Lutheran Choir under David Cherwin going to be performing a concert of, you know, heritage of Lutheran music across the ages. This is going to be a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. And one more. Henry Gehrke is putting together right now, even as we speak, this beautiful hymn festival built around Dear Christians, One and All Rejoice, Luther's first great hymn. I mean, he wrote one hymn before that, but this is his first great hymn where he seeks to express the gospel in song, and he does such a magnificent job. People always want to sing, I love to tell the story, and I'm like, the problem with it is it doesn't tell the story. But Dear Christians, One and All Rejoice, it tells the story. It doesn't talk about loving to do it. It just does it. And a great, great, great piece. So please, plan on joining us. If you are a pastor, if you are a musician, if you are a lady who is interested in worship, this conference is going to be for you. One more thing, opening and closing the conference will be settings, brand new settings of Divine Service 5, which is basically our synod's adaptation of Luther's Deutsche Messe, his German Mass. Simpler setting for smaller congregations and choirs, by Jacob Weber, and then the big blowout festival congregation. I mean, for like if you're at, you know, St. Paul de Pere, where you've got, you know, musical resources that just don't end. You got a Mark Bender at the organ. That service is going to be set for us by Jonathan Coors. CPH will have, or is planning on having anyway, both settings available for purchase by congregations to think about for their Reformation anniversary celebration on the day of the Reformation anniversary itself this year. Anyway, looks like it's going to be a blast, and thank you for letting me at least let the people know about it. Registration is not yet up. We're working as hard as we can to get that website up and going. As soon as that is available, we will let you guys know. And we just put the save the date out only a few days ago.
You can get more information on the 2017 Institute on Liturgy, Preaching, and Church Music, July the 25th through the 28th, held at the campus of Concordia University, Chicago, at lcms.org/worship. And then, of course, registration is coming soon. So now we have this man clothed up to this point, mm-hmm. to the stole.
The stole. And that, in our parlance, that means a man has been ordained. That's usually what we use with the stole to signify. But now, additionally, in many of our parishes now, you see a recovery of what was very common at the time of the Reformation, and that is that the celebrant, the pastor who is the presiding minister at the divine service, the one who will speak the words of institution, he's clothed in something called the chasuble. And the chasuble is it literally means like little house. It's a poncho. And again, it tends to reflect the color of the season, although it can just be a tapestry, but it tends to reflect the color of the season. And it simply marks the man out who is wearing it as that's the one who is going to speak the words of Jesus that will give us his body and blood in and out of the bread and wine.
So what we're seeing there is, and this is, if you want to see, kind of picture this in your mind, folks, if you picture kind of your typical Roman Catholic priest standing at an altar,
yes.
Not to say that these things are Roman Catholic, but they tend to do this pretty well.
Yeah.
You will see the man standing there, and he will be wearing a large, sometimes rather ornate
poncho.
It does look like a poncho. Looks a lot like a poncho. And underneath it, all these other vestments that he's wearing.
And one other that, you know, my own pastor, that he's been a guest here for you guys pretty frequently, he will sometimes wear the maniple too, which is kind of like, if you will, a stole for your arm. It was originally like the napkin that hung down from his picture the waiter. Remember, if you go to a real fancy restaurant, the waiter will have the napkin over his arm, right? That's the pastor's mantle hanging down as well. So that can be worn as well. Those are the Eucharistic vestments. One last thing that we should mention is that underneath, usually holding the stole to the body and the alb to the body is just a rope. It always sounds more ecclesiastical if you put it in Latin, so they call it a cincture, but that's just Latin for your, you know, to cinch, to make a rope, to make it tight.
A belt of rope.
A belt.
Now, there are variations on this. There are also additions to this. Before we go to the lay garments, if you would, sometimes we'll see... I'll give an example. We recently interviewed Bishop Litkin of the Siberian mm-hmm. Church, and he can be seen Googled online, and he often is wearing the so-called pointed hat. He is a bishop.
The mitre.
What is that?
Oh, the mitre was just, do you remember how in the description of both the garments for Aaron and the garments for Joshua, the high priest in Zechariah 3, you had... mention of the turban for his head. The mitre is just like a Western form of the turban, if you will. It's a hat. And the hat, again, simply designates the man who is wearing it as bishop. And usually a bishop not only wears the mitre to show that, think of it like a crown of sorts, if you will. He also will wear or will hold the crozier, which is the big staff that shows he is the... As bishop, he's to be the shepherd of the church there.
It's a very stylized shepherd's crook.
It's a shepherd's crook, yeah. And then many times you'll see him wearing a cope, although other people wear the cope too. And a cope, again, just change one vowel and you get a cape. That's what it is. It's a cape. But usually, again, it can be a neutral color, but the brocade usually on it will at least match the color of the season that the church is celebrating. And that's worn as a very festive garment. I think when President Harrison was installed, Bishop Obari wore a cope and mitre and Crozier, I think, at that service.
So it's a celebratory, kind of above and beyond.
Yeah. Well, our friend, our good friend, Pastor Michael Kumm, has an absolutely glorious cope that he will many times wear when he comes to different celebrations in Synod.
And he'll wear it at occasional services, like weddings and things like that. So that's the clergy vestments. How are the lay assistants at the Divine Service?
The key to the lay assistants are that the vestments are going to basically be the base vestments. So think cassock and surplice or alb. If there is a difference with the cassock and the surplice, many, many times the surplice is severely shortened, in which case it becomes called a kata. And there's a special kind of surplice that the organist can use that has sliced sleeves so that his arms are free either to conduct the choir or to play the organ. These are, anyone serving in the church is sort of given these vestments to wear. You see them on children who serve as acolytes, candlelighters, or on children who are serving as crucifers, or adults who are serving as crucifers or torchbearers, or people carrying the processional cross. They'll usually be vested either in alb or in cassock and surplice. And I think there was a time that people, it shows in Dr. Maxwell's book, that he showed a decided preference to try to keep it one or the other, so that if the pastor is wearing the alb, the assistant should be wearing the alb. But I've just noticed across the church, it's just mix and match everywhere. And so, for example, at the church that I worship at, the crucifer and the torchbearers or the acolyte, they're going to be wearing cassock and surplice. The pastor who's celebrating is wearing alb and chasuble and maybe maniple and stole. And the other assistant many times will be either vested in an alb or in cassock and surplice. And, you know, it's just all mixed and matched up there. And this beautifully expresses the adiaphoristic nature of what's going on there. There are no right and wrong rules here. And when Maxwell shows his preference for making it all uniform, I think he's just showing he was always a man who liked things to be neat and tidy.
Pastor Will Wheaton's our guest, part 7 of our series, Setting the Lord's Table, talking about the vestments for clergy and lay assistants in the divine service on this Thursday afternoon, January the 19th. About another 10 minutes with him, then we'll be reviewing the movie Silence with Pastor Ted Giese. Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us. Doxology.us.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as Confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the clcc.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a Confessional Lutheran. TheCLCC.org.
Theology for Blue Collar, White Collar, and Clerical Collar. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Come and experience firsthand by sitting down in classes and actually hearing professors, coming to chapel, which is always the high point of the day, to hear the Word of God and to lift our voices in song.
Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Paul Grimm on why you should consider visiting Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Spend time talking to professors. I mean, there's not a professor here who will not be willing to take time, whether it's after chapel during the coffee hour or just to come into one study and sit down and talk for a while, to answer questions, to, you know, help them to get a sense of, A, you know, do they want to be a pastor or a deaconess? And then B, is this the right place? And, well, maybe C would be the question, is now the right time for them to make that decision?
If you've contemplated the vocation of pastor or deaconess, contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or send an email to admission@ctsfw.edu. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd. Welcome back to another 5 minutes with Pastor Will Wheaton, wrapping up part seven of our series on setting the Lord's table. We're talking about the vestments and for both the clergy and the lay assistants in the divine service. And you said it's important for us to note something. And here again, we're not uniform in our practice.
No.
And that is, whose clothes
are they?
Whose they hang in the closet in the vestry. Who do they belong to, or who should they belong
Historically,
to?
Historically, the way that the church dealt with this was that the vestments belonged to the parish. They belonged to the congregation itself. And this is huge, because it's a way that, you know, if you got a pastor that you know, his, I don't know, he has 10 children and he doesn't have a lot of money, it's okay. The congregation's got that covered. You know, for beauty and for glory, these vestments can still be there and still be used and maintained. And then the congregation, and this is an important point too, the congregation actually maintains them, i.e. usually the altar guild maintains them. Why is that a good idea? Well, Todd, you tell me how diligent you think pastors are about keeping nice vestments, about keeping their vestments clean even, let alone not wrinkled and all that stuff. So, you know, considering how brutish we men tend to be with these things, it's usually a beautiful thing to have the entire set of garments, the property of the parish. And then one other factor that really helps here is, I mean, visually, is that everything then matches. I don't know if you've ever been to a parish where the pastor has his own stoles. I had my own. I'll give you a classic instance on this. I had my own green. My wife made it, you know, a nice olive green, which clashed hugely with the green that the congregation had on their altar when they, you know, with the kind of tapestry look up there, brocade. And that's avoided if the congregation has complete sets, so that the paraments match the vestments, match the stole, match the chasuble. Even if they have their maniples, match the maniple. Everything ties together and looks coordinated and orderly. What you don't want to have happen when you sit down in the congregation and look up in the morning is to go, "Oh my, that really doesn't go, does it?" You know, that's what you try to avoid with the vestments. That's contrary to what they're there to do. One other thing that I think is really important with the thought of the universality of the vestments, if you open up, there's a delightful book that a German fellow did with historic vestments that have survived from different eras in Lutheranism, right? And if you look at how they were celebrating the Eucharist then, and you went to, well, the place that I worship, for example, you would go, "Oh yeah, of course, the same thing's going on," right? And significantly, if you backed it up 500 years before the Reformation and looked at what was going on, you'd look at it and go, "Oh, look, we know exactly what's going on. That person's the celebrant for the Eucharist. Or that person's wearing a cope and not a chasuble. He's probably getting ready to, lead matins or vespers or something like that." The continuity that the practice has just kind of says our church is part of the church Catholic. Although I'm not sure why we give them the big C. The history of the church is shown in these historic vestments. Again, I can't stress it enough. Lutherans didn't get their knickers in knots over this. There were places that kept it fully. There were places where they let things go. There were places that sort of did halfway in between. Lutherans are not going to fight about vestments. But Lutherans did recognize there's a value to this universality, and there's a value to having a clear demarcation of role by what someone's wearing.
Pastor Will Whedon is our guest. He's director of worship and chaplain of the International Center for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He hosts a radio talk show called Thy Strong Word, and he is author of the book Celebrating the Saints. If you would like to read Celebrating the Saints, it's one of those things you can have with you all year long, and it isn't just read once, it's read over and over again. It's a devotional resource following the course of the church year that takes you through all of the observations of the church year. Celebrating the Saints by Pastor Will Whedon. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, and order Celebrating the Saints, 1-800-325-3040. Pastor Whedon, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Todd. I appreciate it.
We will be reviewing the movie Silence with Pastor Ted Giese right after this break.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
The third commandment teaches us to remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. We do this when we hold God's word sacred and gladly hear and learn it. Jesus invites the weak and heavy laden to rest in him, our true rest, because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. This weekend, rest in Jesus as you hear his word and receive his gifts. If you are in Southern Illinois, you're invited to join Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstatt to rest in the grace of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Learn more at trinitymillstatt.org.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.